And again, I would like to ask if anybody has a topic they would like me to discuss today.
I'd like to suggest the theme of death in context that recently three people died one after another, and they were all devotees of God, because a different tradition describe this such kind of events with little differences. So this is the theme he wants to suggest.
What would you like to know about that theme?
I'd like to suggest to discuss and to know how it is exactly going on, because it is described we go there and our angels, Dharmaraj, Yamaraj, they
bring us. So what is it he wants to know? How exactly the process of death takes place?
Yeah,
what happens
especially
afterwards?
In unordinary circumstances, like a person disappears suddenly and nobody even know about it. They found out even later. And
okay. Registered. Any other topics that you're interested in? Yes.
How to accept oneself as you are without resistance and to love oneself because...
Yes, how to accept yourself as you are?
And how to love yourself because we tend to resist this.
Okay. Others?
If it's possible, could you please describe your mystical experience from your childhood and how it was developing? If it's okay.
Others?
As a continuation of the previous question, how to accept oneself and how to accept others?
Okay, I have a pretty... Yes?
What progressive changes do you notice on our planet nowadays?
It's interesting, though, how all of these things are related. The childhood is related to that which has come before it, before the birth. That which is before the birth is the death of the previous life. That's one of the events. And what's a significant factor is how we are accepting ourselves, how we are understanding ourselves. And that's very much related to the progress on Earth today. So that's a theme. Do you like this theme? Or do you want to hear something else? It's your chance to tell me. Okay, we go with it. Many times in our lives, we think about death. It's not something we think about all the time. But when we become very philosophical, especially at funerals, we think about it. I remember in my childhood, the first time I went to a funeral, I was deeply affected by it. My grandfather was laying there in the funeral home. And although he looked the same, kinda, he was very different. And I had a very hard time with that. I had a very hard time relating to the whole experience of the funeral. I think that was related to one of my earliest experiences when I understood in my childhood that something's not right. It was almost like, I'm here, okay, I'm a kid, this is my family, and this is what I'm doing, but something's not right. Some people still feel like that, even though they're quite old. I know many people have this feeling. This is a feeling like I don't belong here, or I just can't connect to the world around me. Can you guys kind of? So in the past, you don't find that so much in books, novels, literatures. You don't find that so much. You don't find that theme so much. Basically, people, according to the historical information, basically people felt like they were here and they had to deal with it. Now, that could be related to the fact that life was very difficult in the past. If you think about it, no running water, no sewer systems, no refrigerators, no electricity, no telephones. When it was cold out, the only thing you could do was burn wood, but to get the wood, you had to do a lot of work, cutting the trees, chopping the wood, getting it ready. And all of this takes an enormous amount of time. Therefore, people's time was usually taken up with all of these tasks. And there were very few people who had the resources that they could have servants doing it. But even amongst those people, we don't find so much discussion about this feeling of uncertainty about my existence. Nietzsche addressed it. Starting around the 1800s, you have a couple of authors addressing it, but they were very much in the fringe of intellectual circles. Since the last, I don't know how many years, let's say within our lifetimes, there has been a very strong movement, not as in an organized sense, but a motion among society to wonder in a way we haven't wondered before. Like, what are we really doing here? There are many people, and I'm sure, like when I speak about this, when I first started talking, many people in this room started going like this when I said, I don't feel like I belong. Many people are going, yeah, I've felt that, I've fought that. Now, religions have tried to fill that void, have tried to give us an answer of why we're here, what we're supposed to do. And religions have also given us an answer, so to speak, about death. And so far, up until our lifetimes, people have been very comfortable accepting these definitions, accepting this. But we're starting to see now this very interesting transformation where people are not very satisfied with these definitions of death, where people are not very happy with the definitions about themselves. One of the topics over here is about feeling good about yourself, accepting yourself, understanding yourself, coming in contact with yourself. Religions dealt with this issue in a way which may not have been very compatible with us as people. The definitions of ourselves as servants or as very small, insignificant, sinful people in relationship to God doesn't sit well with us anymore. So I see these themes which have come up as being a kind of like feeling of, you know, how do we deal with these ideas which we were born into, but we cannot wear comfortably? They don't fit us anymore. Indeed, it's something we've outgrown. I'd like to just concentrate on this subject about death, not because death itself is an interesting subject, but because the fact that death doesn't exist is an interesting subject. Now, death, you say the word death, and we think, my God, it's like this horrifying experience. But for me, the horrifying aspect of it is being, you know, the moments up to the death, if it's great pain or in some kind of catastrophe or some disaster, you know, I might imagine like some horrifying kind of experience that causes my death. But in that case, it's not the death itself that's the problem. It's these events leading up to death that are the problem. And in fact, death is a relief. Now, that is an interesting point. In other words, it's the suffering of the body or the suffering of the mind or whatever it is. That's the problem, not the death. Death is often a solution. When everybody dies, that's all there is to it. So what actually happens? Let's take this previous example and let's just accept that death itself is a transition. And the real thing to worry about is the painful situation which leads up to the death. And let's just accept that it's one of the many painful situations of life. So let's just consider that precise moment of death and from then on. Now there are many explanations. There are many ways to see it. But let us analyze it strictly from that which is generic. In other words, that which is devoid of designation by a religious group or by an esoteric group or in any way. Just let's be very generic. Now it's interesting that in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says the most generic of all statements. Usually in religious literature, you don't expect that. You expect some kind of very pointed statement. This is a very generic statement. He says, whatever state you're in at the moment of death, that's the state you will be in after death. Now, misunderstandings of language aside, that's precisely the essence of what he says. Whatever you are when you die, you're going to be after you're dead. That's just pure logic. What am I now? Well, let's get very brief about this. I'm this energy field. I'm this energy personality. I'm this spiritual energy personality. And I'm inhabiting a body. My energy is flowing through this body in different ways. Now, when I have these problems, which is another topic here, about feeling about myself not so properly, I'm not very happy with myself, I think I'm bad, or I don't do things right, I have a very low self-esteem. That's entirely connected with the way in which we've acted with the body, or our bodies, or the feeling we have about our situation in the world. Or, even on another level, how we've chosen to act and the consequences that came later of these acts. So, we have this feeling in us that we are meant to be better. Therefore, we're not happy with the way it's manifesting now. There's something in me which feels that its nature is to be quite proper, quite together, even quite beautiful, loving, spiritual. And somehow, this nature has become entangled with various ways in which it's manifested through the body or in relation to other bodies or in the circumstances we're in. So, in a nutshell, according to all religions and all spiritualists, spirit is entangled by matter. But I don't think that's a good way to put it. That makes us think that matter is some like evil personality that comes and captures us and forces us to act improperly. I would rather see it as we have embraced our tools or our ingredients of our life, and we have not properly assessed the consequences of our acts before we chose to do them. Now, our energy, what we really are, that which we feel we are, is actually always there in us. It's always giving this feeling that we are worthy of being loved. We are actually desirous of that connection with other beings. And when our bodies or are somehow defects or whatever it is, causes this natural desire to be hindered, we get very upset. Every one of you, without exception, knows that you're a good person, that you are worthy of being loved, and that you reach out for that love. That's the deepest essence of everybody. The problem is that we embrace all these other ideas which stand between that very basic thing that is in us and the exterior world and other people. So it's kind of our goal, it's kind of our mission in this life to somehow or another find ourselves and find our connections and recapture that which we know is there. That's why every religion has that place. And what is the quality of that place? That place is a place where I am in my original perfection, and I am accepted, and I am loved, and I love. In other words, although we know it's very difficult to have this here, some even say impossible, there's a place where it will be. I just have to go to that place. And what's the way to go to that place? Well, you do certain things, and then you die. And when you die, you go to that place. Now that's why I think it's so significant what Krishna said in the Bhagavad Gita. Whatever state you are at the time of your death, well, right after that, after death, it's the same state. It's not that by dying you get something different. Let's analyze that more because I think that's a very important point. My whole life is a series of events, a whole series of evolutionary experiences. Sometimes my life is very short. Perhaps I have an accident in a car. Perhaps there's some kind of like war and I get hit on the head with a bomb. Sometimes my life is very long and I die after many experiences, many events having taken place. But in each and every case, regardless of the circumstances, the situation at the moment of death is exactly the same. Now, I don't mean the way we take it is the same. I mean the mechanism is exactly the same. Okay, I've oversimplified. I have to be more specific. Let's go back to the generic. My life is a series of events, a series of experiences, and these are creating my forward motion. They're making a progressive evolution. Each and every one of these experiences builds upon my previous experiences. Now sometimes, I'm sorry for this deviation in the discussion, but sometimes people think that evolution means it's step by step upwards. It's a linear thing that you're moving in towards a goal of some kind. I like to see evolution as a growth in all directions. I know it's not a perfect sphere. Sometimes one part of the sphere is bulging out more than the other, which is sunken in. It may be a very ugly looking figure, but it's three-dimensional, not like a two-dimensional linear ladder. Do you understand that figure? It's like if you take like a, you start off with a sphere. Let's say you start off with a sphere. And then you make some evolution in a very specific kind of area. So then you get a bulge in the sphere this way. And then maybe a few bulges in other ways. And maybe the whole sphere is also growing at the same time. This evolution is just a product of our experiences, a product of time, a product of the trials we have gone through, a product of the understandings we have made. And at the moment of death, regardless of how pious you have become in the last few days, you have created a kind of a evolutionary figure that represents all of the aspects of your evolution, but within one being. Now that is a very three-dimensional graphic, but there's a fourth dimension to it. That is your consciousness. The color of your consciousness. All of the qualities of your consciousness as they mix into one homogeneous mass that is you. You're aware of your consciousness. It's what's listening now. It's what's thinking about what I'm saying. It's what's aware. It's what's dealing with your existence, your own universe. It's what's conscious of this body. You know what it is. Now that consciousness has energy. When we do these meditations like last night, and your consciousness is visualizing and connecting with energies and just exploding with power, this is your energy field in action. Your chakras are just receiving and emanating that energy according to your consciousness. So that specific energy field, the homogeneous energy of you, is this conscious evolutionary figure of this multidimensional expansion that has taken place during all our lives. That living mass of energy with its specific form and characteristic according to our evolutionary qualities. We all know this. We feel it. Just like if we do a meditation, even we connect to others. Our particular energy and somebody else's particular energy. Although we can connect, we're very aware, although we are an us, although we are a one, we're very unique individuals. And we're very aware of that at the moment we stop that meditative connection. And we all settle back down to our own personal reality. Now let's take that energy, that energetic mass that we are, and move us just 1 second before death. Now, what is death? Well, technically, it's just the inability of the body to support life. It's a physiological, biochemical situation that is no longer functioning. This body is a mechanism. So without all of the features of the mechanism working compatibly, life cannot be supported. And when life can no longer be supported, that's called death. Now, usually we look at the body and we see the body fall over dead and we go, oh, horrible, death, body, dead, finished, gone. Now, I'm making a joke out of it, but I'm just as shocked as you are when anybody I love would die. I go to pieces. I can't talk to them anymore. I can't do things with them anymore. I can't exchange love with them anymore. It's a horrible thing. But we're all going to die because we are living in a world where there's a limited, guaranteed limitation on the capacity of the living energy, this physiological being, to function. Now, nowhere in death is the energy mass of what we are included. Because it's not a physiological thing. It's not a biochemical thing. It resides within this biophysical form and uses it. It emanates through it. It integrates within it. So that 1 second before death, that exact same form at the moment of death, and 1 second after the death, in 2 seconds doesn't change. So, generically, whatever you are, at the moment of death, you will be right after that. Now just think about that. Where's the ticket to heaven? Well, I don't want to be the one to destroy everybody's dreams. But unless you're already in heaven, why would you go there? If you're not already heavenly, what will be the process right after death to make you heavenly? Let's say you're not heavenly now, and you believe that right after death, you'll be made heavenly. Well, who will do that? Well, you will say, God. Now, I will say, well, God will do it for who? And you will say, well, God will do it for us Christians. And the Jewish people will say, no, God will do it for us Jews. We're the chosen ones. And the Arabs will say, no, God will do it for us. But what is it that you have to do, even as a good Christian or a good Jew or a good Muslim? What is it that you have to do to get God to do that for you? Do you have to do everything the book says? Or what about 98% of it? 68.5%? At what point does God say, see, you only did 50, and actually the cutoff point is 51%, so I can't bring you to I can't transform you to heaven because you're at 51%. But God, I was at 50.99999%. Sorry, we have our cutoff point, that's it. Now, does any of this make sense? As I'm describing it, it's starting to make less sense. The idea that you die and you're somehow transformed to heaven, whatever you want to call it, it's just not very logical. It's based on a belief. I believe that if I'm good in this world and I'm a good fill in the blank for whatever religion, when I die, God will take me to heaven. If I chant so many chants, if I pray so many prayers, if I follow so many disciplines, and I'll just kind of make it over the last cutoff point and then whew. Sometimes people say, according to Hinduism, if you think of God at the time of death, you go to God instantly. So I'm spending my whole life developing love of God. And, you know, I'm ready for when I get old, I'm just going to concentrate. And I'm walking down the street and, you know, I'm just about to cross the street and I'm thinking about all the groceries I have to buy and I'm not paying attention and boom, I get run over and I'm dead. Does that mean I'm going to go in after death to the grocery store? Because that was my consciousness. My consciousness was shopping. And I spent my whole life just trying to develop all kinds of spiritual things, and I die thinking of shopping. Well, every religion realizes that's not fair. So there are various exceptions. And in the footnotes, there are footnotes to this. It is said, well, if you die like that, don't worry, God will remember all the good stuff you did. And so it'll be all right for you. Or, let's say, I'm just really a rotten creep my whole life. And by chance, I die in the right way. Those of you who know what I'm talking about know where it goes from here. These are beliefs. Things which defy logic, things which defy our experience, things which defy this generic truth that as I die, whatever that state is, the very next moment after death is the same state I'm in. Now, I don't feel very happy. I'm not happy engaging in this discussion which rips apart various scriptural ideas. I don't like to do this. But, you know, okay, I have my own experience. I have certain experiences. And I have seen, how do I say this without sounding silly? I'll just say it. And I'm really sorry if it sounds weird, but I have seen many times people who were supposed to be very great spiritualists, who should have gone straight back to Godhead, so to speak, after death become very confused. I'm a very private person. I don't like to tell people about what I do. I kind of keep it behind closed doors. But most people really have faith that if they just do certain things in their lifetime, even if they don't transform their consciousness to the heavenly state, they'll just die and go flying back to God. So you can imagine, here is this very elevated, so-called, very spiritual person. I'm not going to deny it. And they're just gradually coming to the point of death. They're looking forward to it. They've been so sick. And all around them are all these spiritual things. And when finally they die, they go running out of their body. Finally, I'm going back to God. And they may go flying up, but then it's like they look around. And then they settle back to the exact state of their consciousness as it was actually that mass of evolution consciousness just before death. Look, we all get fired up. We get enthusiastic. And in our fired up enthusiasm, we can just conquer the world. But we always come back to reality. And then people like that, they realize, oh, it was not that way I thought. Now, that's what Krishna said. What you were, you will be. Yet we think we get that to heaven. So then those persons, they come back down and they start groping around for some help. Sometimes I've seen that they're even more bewildered. I can't even believe I'm saying this. They're more bewildered than a regular person who dies with very little expectation or just wonderment or... I mean, I feel so sad about this. And then they kind of find people that they did something wrong to, and they're trying to apologize. They think they did something wrong. That's why they're in this state. And they're trying to apologize, and they're trying to get some connection so that they can make it right. And they're trying to make sense and trying to get some help. So this, I see. It's one of the unfortunate things that I have to live with. Regular people, I use that term loosely, regular people, they're not very confident about what will happen. They don't have any preconceived notion. It's kind of like, what's going to happen? Sometimes they feel angels coming to them. Because they're not expecting and they're just like reaching out, the angels come and just hold them. Sometimes they dial with a smile. Many nurses say that in the hospital. Not all. Some die in incredible struggle. Now, religion would say, I'm not saying these things are wrong, but I just want to examine them practically. When you're a bad person, you're punished and you get these creatures come and take you to punishment and you go to hell. Now, can you believe that God would create a hell that you can never get out of and you just burn in eternally? Now, you're a regular person and you have some love. Now, I put you in charge right now to create the destinations for people after death. Would any of you create such a destination? Would you feel good to create a hell you could never get out of and where there's eternal burning and horror? I don't think so. And why would God do it? This person who's all love. What would you create? I know what I would create. A healing center. A place to go to where you would be healed from all of the traumas of your life. A place where all the good about you would be amplified. A place where all the bad things, the negative energy would be purified and you would be educated. And in fact, after you left this body, you would immediately see, oh, that was all wrong. You look back on everything you're leaving and you're saying, oh no, why did I do like that? How did I get entangled like that? And if I was in charge, I would tell that person, come, take my hand. And come, here, let's talk about it. Let's look at those situations. Look at that moment when you made that choice. And look at this moment where you did this wonderful thing. Try to understand more about yourself. Look, what is your conclusion? What's the best way for you to deal with it? Some people come out of that state of death and they are so distorted and twisted in their energy, they can't even function after death. So we take them to a place of healing alone, where they can just work out their energy and just calm it down, settle it down. Now, this is what actually is going on. The idea that there's a God who says, you're bad, go to hell. It's absurd. Now, some people actually experience it like that. Let's talk about that. Whatever state you're in, you enter into that state. Let's say you really believe in hell. You are totally convinced that bad people burn in hell. And although you may not talk about it with others, you are totally convinced you're one of those bad people. And even though you don't really outwardly show it, inside you really are afraid of that death. So you, at the time of death, just embrace that hell because you think you deserve it. Some people do that. But they don't stay there forever. Because at one point they say, why am I actually here? Isn't there somewhere else to be? And then, certainly, I don't even know how people can accept that there is a God who creates hell. This goes hand in hand with the religious idea that everything that is created, everything that exists, everything is there because of God. Therefore, many rabbis became atheists after the Holocaust. How could God do this to us? Now, all of this horror that is there in the world, and hey, there's a lot of it. These are man-made things. These are the products of our choices, the products of our actions, the products of our desire. And the earth is just reflecting that. God is not creating this. In God's original arrangement, it is very beautiful. Enter man, and man, by various ways and means, makes it less than beautiful. And man can make it beautiful again. We all know that. So, man makes hell, not God. And I might suggest man makes heaven too. Now, so far we've talked basically about death and where things end up, but how about that evolutionary step towards our paradise? Let's say, okay, we've gone through this healing after death. We've gone through this. We've understood. We're peaceful. We know how to transform in the next lifetime. So we take birth again. But what about those people who have really evolved quite far and wish to move to more places of light? Now, another one of my personal realizations, take it for what it's worth, is not that heaven or the spiritual realm is a geographical distance quite far away. There's this place, and then there's that place, and the other place, or maybe some other place around the whole thing, and you move through these geographical locations and finally get to different destinations. Many of us are aware that in the etheric realm, there is no time. In the etheric realm, there is no space. Some people who do healing can bring the sick to them and do healing in any location, no matter how far away they are. You can, if you wish, if you're sensitive, connect to another person, even though they're very far away. Time and space do not exist on the etheric platform. If you have a powerful radio station, if you're 5 kilometers away, you're 100 kilometers away, it doesn't matter. You just need to tune to the right frequency. So all of these spiritual destinations are multidimensional frequencies. And when your consciousness, your mass of evolutionary energy is tuned to a particular dimension, then you're experiencing it even here. It's not a question of going somewhere. And there are unlimited kinds of dimensions on this etheric platform. Practically unlimited varieties of realities that you may go to, connect to. So, those who wish to simply be together with the Supreme, wish to be together with Radha and Krishna, they may do so in that dimensional frequency of harmonization and resonance. Those who actually resonate that way are already connected. Whether they're living or not doesn't matter. And at their death, they just continue to resonate that way, and they are surrounded by that harmonic dimension. For example, love attracts love. Hate attracts hate. Anger attracts anger. Money attracts money. These are just basic principles. When you are resonating in a certain way, you attract that around you which is appropriate. Why is it when two people meet, even a beautiful boy and a beautiful girl, if they're resonating in different ways, it just doesn't work? What works is when you're on the same frequency. That's why good marriages are based on this harmonic resonance of the energies of the people. So this connection to a spiritual world or the heaven or the celestial realm is based on our resonating according to that kind of divine energy. And these lives we have now are opportunities to tune ourselves to the resonances of our choice. And the reason I am trying to analyze and pick apart these beliefs we have had for so long, even religious beliefs, is because they are basically dampening our capacity to feel our own resonance. Many ideas of what we should be and what we should not be, what we should do and what we should not do, and who we should follow and be like. These are devotees, those are demons. These are friends, these are enemies. These are us, and those are them. And we are us because we do the right thing. They are them because they do the wrong thing. And if you are one of the ones who do the right thing and you do the wrong thing, you become one of them. Therefore, you should always stick to the flock and be one of us. So everybody watches everybody to make sure that they are still one of us. Where I live, this is going on all the time. I live in an area where there's a lot of Hare Krishnas in Alachua. And they're always watching each other. What are they doing? What are they doing? Oh, it's amazing, but it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that religion has practically flooded out or extinguished the fire of the individual's capacity to feel and resonate and harmonize in a beautiful way with the Supreme, with the Divine. I always wondered why Krishna said in the Bhagavad Gita, and when you've really, you know, come to the truth, you're not going to worry about what you've heard or all the things before. It just, you forget about all that. Now, it's interesting when you think about it, how we have accepted, not only if we were religious, but in our societies, we have accepted principles which are dampening us as individuals, where there are standards. You have to look a certain way. Therefore, before we leave our rooms, we make sure we look appropriately. And when we don't look appropriately, we feel bad. And everybody else looks at us like, you're not appropriate. What's wrong with you? And in your actions and in what you do and where you live and which car you drive, and when you meet people, how you're supposed to greet each other, how you're supposed to laugh at other people's jokes, millions of things. And when you can't do this properly, or you've made some mistakes, you begin to embrace the idea that there's something wrong with you. And what's the worst of all? The original offenses against God. I don't mean the original sin. I mean when you're a baby and you displease your mother and father and they don't appreciate you. They don't acknowledge you. And it creates a tear in your heart that stays with you for your whole life. And you look for the rest of your life for other people to acknowledge you, other people to appreciate you, other people to give you what you didn't have when you were a child. And when you don't get it from them, you say, I'm bad. They don't acknowledge me. They don't appreciate me because I'm bad. And you can't look in the mirror and look in your eyes and say, I love you, because you don't. Because how can you love somebody who's so bad as you? So you're spending your whole time resonating in that way. And religion doesn't help because you're sinful and you're fallen. And you are not acting properly, and you're not perfect. So wherever you look, you're a failure. Some people then say, no, I'm going to make so much money, everyone's going to worship me. These beautiful ladies say, I'm going to be so beautiful, I'm going to melt you on the spot, and you will appreciate me. And us musicians think we're going to play so good, you're just going to think we're the greatest. And I'm going to speak so perfectly, you're going to think I'm a real spiritual guy. And you're going to put these absurd signs in the hallway, which I want to rip into little pieces, which say how wonderful I am. But it doesn't work. It doesn't change the things. Because as long as you accept that there's this all around you, which is dampening your individual spirit, you're never going to make it to those other dimensions. Therefore, when I'm ripping apart in analysis all of these religious ideas, all of these psychological ideas, and so on, it's only for one purpose. You are all there is in your evolution, you are the most important personality in your life. That's not just words, because that also means you've got responsibility. Because you are responsible for what you do. You are responsible for what you think. You are responsible for the choices you make. You are responsible for the evolution you make. You are responsible for how you accept these experiences that are there. Andrew Weil says, all healing is self-healing. I say all evolution is self-evolution. I don't mean this to be an incredible form of selfishness. I mean it to be that instead of thinking the responsibility to determine what's right and wrong belongs to someone else, some group or some parent or some societal norm, I say the responsibility belongs to you. According to what you do and according to what you choose, you're going to get that destination. So therefore, embrace that responsibility and see that your relationship with others doesn't depend on a philosophical ideal. It depends on actually how you feel about others. It depends on how your consciousness can understand the plight of others. And instead of seeing, here, this person not following the rules, therefore they're bad, you say, here, that person's just like me, struggling with the same things I'm struggling with, in a different way. So instead of chastising them or criticizing them or judging them, let me try to be of service and be of assistance. That's what I do. I'm a coach. That means I'm trying to instill within you the idea that you're something really special. But not in the way that, oh, we're all very special and thus no one is special. But in the way that I can resonate in whatever way I want, and I can thus develop contact with other beings that I want, and I can attain dimensions and live in realms I want. Is that not special? It seems so to me. And the only thing stopping us from doing that is some external thing saying, no, no, no. My idea is if somebody comes up to me and says, this is not right what you're doing and it's wrong, do I have to believe it? Now, if what they say influences me in such a way that I wish to make a transformation, that's my choice. If somebody comes up to me and says, this is the truth, and if I am to understand why it's the truth, they say, because it has been written, because it has been spoken, I don't necessarily have to believe that. If it resonates with my personal experience, I might. But it's my choice. I don't have to. So therefore, I avoid to enter into a group configuration where for my to remain in the group configuration, I have to give up my individual choice. And it's funny because the more individual I am, the more individualistic I am, the more I keep my own integrity, the easier it is for me to connect to everybody else. Isn't that strange? It's completely counterintuitive in one sense. According to everything we've learned, the idea that the more individualistic you become, the easier it is for you to connect to others, it's a strange idea. And when I go out to places where there's a lot of people of a certain kind of religion, it can be anyone, and they're all together and they're in their group and I don't feel connected to anybody. And even the people who accept that group don't feel connected to each other. It's one of the symptoms of groups. So it seems to me, by my experience, that the progression of society is the development of the respect of the individual's right, the individual's energy, and the individual's choice. And if I respect myself, if I love myself, I can actually respect you and love you for what you are. And if I can't respect and love myself, I can't respect and love you. Love starts right here. And if I can't even do it with myself, then how am I ever going to do it for anyone else? Otherwise, it's just love me, make me feel good. Love me and acknowledge me and justify and make my existence important and real. Validate me. And I say, love thyself. Love yourself. Because then you can love others. It begins with the individual, with me, with you, each and every one of us. And then you may expand that in loving relationships with others. And like yesterday, we explained, that's exactly how Lord Chaitanya spread love. He just embraced people. And then it spread like that, one by one by one by one. I think that's the progression of all of this understanding of religion, politics, economics, everything, is to understand what is valuable, and it all boils down to the individual. I hope I have said something which has some value to you. That's the only point of my speaking. And if it resonates with you and helps you build up your own space in your spiritual dimensions that you connect to, I'll be very happy. This is my service.
Last lecture, you described about airplane crash near New York and how one person would help others to lift up to the helicopter. And he himself died there. Maybe he was like this during all his life. We don't know this.
Maybe.
Может быть. But I know one story about one captain who was a very cruel person in life. He would always beat his soldiers when they would come to him. He was very cynical and cold-hearted. He even killed a few people in his life. But once when his ship started to drown and there was fire on it, he was helping to save his soldiers, to help them to go on saving boats. And when almost every soldier was saved, he ran for other soldiers which left on the ship. And at that time, the ship exploded. And I want to ask about it. Is it possible that there can be some strong impulse at the last moment which can change further advancement of a person?
Look, nobody's all good, nobody's all bad. That in itself is an answer to your question. Anybody, even if they're bad in life, can have a change of heart at any time. And that in itself is an answer to your question. The thing that people have a hard time understanding is that people who are in a certain situation which is very quote-unquote bad, they're there for a reason. You can almost always trace it back to a really horrifying childhood. Sexually abused as a child. Or in a horrifying social situation and having to do horrible things which were incompatible with a child. There's piles of reasons, many different reasons, why a person becomes bad. Now, one may say, rightfully so, still they could have chosen to do the right thing. I came from a very good family. I had a pretty good childhood. You would expect me to do the right thing all the time. Sometimes I get very frustrated. Sometimes I get very angry. Situation around me just becomes so tense and I feel so much stress and I get so frustrated. I just become crazy for a short time. And I may do something terrible. Does that make me bad? Circumstances, I couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't handle it. I get frustrated and I lash out at the world. So if I'm generally okay, people would look at me and say, oh, well, he just had a bad day. We can forgive him. But maybe your captain had a real bad life, starting from day one. And he was always so frustrated and so feeling unloved and feeling so bitter, he just lashed out at others. But there's not one person on this planet that doesn't want to love and be loved, to be appreciated and be acknowledged. This captain gave up. He just couldn't figure out how to do it in any other way. He was just frustrated. He had already lost the battle of being good. Here was this opportunity. How to finally, in a final way, when he couldn't be hurt for it, display his love by saving these men. Maybe when that captain was a child, he would come to his mother to hug her or feel love, and she would slap him and throw him away and tell him, go fetch water from the well. One learns, showing love means getting pain. So what does one do? One shows the opposite of love to avoid pain. But now the ship is blowing up. It's obviously going to sink. I'm the captain. Now I can actually do something for once in my life, which is a demonstration of my love, and actually save these people who I am so close to, and then die at the end so that no one can hurt me for it. Now, no one thinks like this. When we see stories of bad people and horrible people and miserable people, we don't really understand how they got there. Okay, I'm not saying if there's a madman out there killing everybody, you shouldn't stop him. I'm not saying that. And I'm not saying that you should allow them to run free and create more problems. But you should understand the possibilities of how they got to be like that. The worst thing is to put them all in jail. Can you imagine? You've got all these people with all these problems, all having the same kind of frustrations, and you put them all in one place, lock them up. And what do you think is going to happen in there with this resonation amongst all these dysfunctional people? And maybe there's even a couple of good people in there who were in there because they just went crazy momentarily. So every kind of situation where you're keeping the criminals away from society should obviously include some kind of therapeutic situation. When you go on the other side after you die and you are met, you're not looked at for your acts, bad acts. You're looked at for the pain and trauma you had to go through, which created you or created the situation which caused you so much pain that you reacted like this. And therefore, to cure, you don't punish the crime, you heal the trauma. That's what they do. That's a model.
Could you please explain what these responsibilities that we have in front of whom we should be responsible in front of social opinion or social court, in front of a divine court or in front of our own court?
That's a different subject that you're bringing up. And it's also a good one. So I'll answer your question in two stages. When we assume personal responsibility for our life, for our spiritual life, for our evolution, for our healing, that means we assume the responsibility to find out, figure out, bring to ourselves what we need and what we want to evolve. We're not responsible to anyone else for that. Others may wish us to evolve, may encourage us to evolve. But we're not responsible to them. We're only to ourselves. Okay, but obviously we don't live in a vacuum. We don't live alone. No man is an island, as they say. We live within a society. We live within families. We live within communities. And because of that, we assume responsibilities appropriate to our positions in these groups. And thus we become responsible to act in the best way for the interests of these others. Let's say you have a business and I work for you. We make an agreement. I have to work a certain amount of hours every day, and I have to accomplish a certain amount of tasks. I'm responsible to you to accomplish that, and you will therefore pay me when I have responsibly done my task. That's different. Those are responsibilities I assume to fulfill my main responsibility of taking care of myself. But when it comes to my evolution, when it comes to my being, when it comes to my energy, when it comes to my destination after death or whatever, that's my responsibility. And along my path of life, as I walk my path, my responsibility is to be the best person I can be and to do the greatest good I can do and evolve as best I can. Is that okay? No. Okay, then why not? Go ahead.
About example of this captain, he probably wouldn't blame himself, but how much he was responsible towards himself for what he was.
I don't get it.
You said that there could be a lot of reasons why he was afraid to manifest his love.
Yes.
No. But these causes, these reasons were not created by him. At the same time, it seems that there was a question of his responsibility towards himself for his development.
Oh, I see. Are you saying because we are placed against our will in negative situations and that very much affects our capacity to evolve individually?
I think mostly they are limiting us and we have no possibility to manifest our own will, and mostly all our activities depend on external factors.
Okay, that's a good point, really good point. How do we deal with the limitations that are placed upon us that are out of our control? Isn't that the essence of what you're saying? Great point. But that point is only relevant in the sense of our not taking the step to do something for ourselves. Regardless of my external situation, I can always take the step to come in contact with my being. Now, maybe we're not inclined to do it because of these limitations. And this is an important point because we might not be ready for it. We are those people from the past. We have all been following religions. We've all been that captain. We've all been the farmers. We've all been the lords. We've all been these people. Life after life, we have been going through these different experiences and situations. But now, it's very interesting. We have an opportunity. And what is that opportunity? We're ready to find out about our being. We've already done that. We've already done that. We've already done that. Okay, you know, but there's got to be something else too. So we reach out. And we come together in groups like this. And we concentrate on our being. It's not that just because limitations don't just limit us, because I have limitations. I still concentrate on my being because I choose to do so. I might not have chosen to do so last lifetime considering my limitations. But now I do, because now the time is right. My evolution has taken me to the point where, yes, now I shall. But I have less, perhaps, limitations. But then the next discussion is why these limitations are there in the first place. That's for some other time. The short answer is because we need them. Good question, though. Took a while to understand it, but good question.
You have described us today that there can be places or facilities there on the other side to clean, to purify the soul. But are there such facilities here in this world, in this reality?
Yes. Absolutely. Because those dimensions are just other dimensions. You can experience those dimensions by tuning to that. You can tune to healing dimensions. There's even a whole science based on that. I forgot the name.
Another question is, on your first lecture, you said there are different schools, different traditions, and you said such a phrase that they cannot be united, integrated. But it seems that now in the world there is a different tendency to, there are predictions that all confessions, all those traditions and schools will be united and integrated.
I don't remember saying that. But if anyway, forget the point. If there is an integration, and I would love it if there was, the integration would be on the level of the essence that's similar in all. Which means everybody in each religion would have to understand what the essence is. And then integrate that essence. Because, for example, the Hindus don't want to kill the cow and the Muslims want to kill the cow. That's very hard to integrate. Just one example. So all of the things that make religions what they are, that's not really important, all these external things. The only thing would be the essence. And if the essence can integrate, fine. Okay?
In relation to the question of that person, Kamalasana, who asked about personal responsibility, I can comment that I worked for a long time in psychiatric hospital, and there, those doctors, they often become very cruel because they deal with very people who are helpless, and they have a good opportunity to like revenge on them their own problems, and they become cruel. And I understand that there is a responsibility to react in a different way.
Yes, very much so. Please ask in Russian so everybody else can hear.
I have a very short question. How to learn to listen one's own heart?
How to learn to see. Now, do you have to... I'm giving it. How to learn to see. Do you look? If you look, your eyes hurt. And if you just look, you see. But looking is not just looking. It's also paying attention. You may quickly look somewhere and then you look back. And if you paid attention to something, you'll know what it is. I quickly looked over there and I saw that lady on the end was wearing, I guess, this blue kind of coat with a lapel and a white kind of blouse. Quick, I looked. So, I didn't usually look. I don't look like that because I don't pay attention. I'm just looking at you, you know, I don't care what you're wearing. But I purposely look. What is she wearing? I'm paying attention. Now my looking's not just looking. Let's say you're listening to somebody speak. Many times I know when people are asking, or people when speaking, that what... while somebody else is speaking, all they're really doing is thinking about what they're going to say and they can't wait for the other to finish. So they don't really care what the other person's saying because that's not the point for them. The point for them is to speak. What makes a friend a friend? Because when you speak, they listen. Just listening to somebody, just hearing somebody is such a monumental thing. Why do we like to go to psychotherapists? Because we talk, they listen. They actually listen. And they're not thinking about what they're going to say. What a relief to actually talk to somebody who listens to what you say. So, you want to listen to yourself? Stop talking to yourself. And when you hear... stop thinking about what you're going to say. What does that mean? It means just to be still. And if you hear something, don't think of your response. Don't think, no, that can't be. Just accept it. When somebody's speaking, don't start thinking, that can't be, that can't be, that can't be. Maybe it's so that they're cheating you, but first, just accept it. That's what psychotherapists do. They go, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you just listen and go, mm-hmm. And you'll be amazed at what the self can say. If the self knows you're listening, the self probably has a lot to say. So do a lot of, mm-hmm. And why do you feel like that? Mm-hmm. And how does that make you feel? Mm-hmm. After all it's healing is self-healing. I know I made that kind of into a joke, but it's really like that. Uh-huh. Oh, really? That's interesting. Can you tell me more about that? It's amazing. You go to school for like 6 years to be a psychotherapist and you have a vocabulary of mainly like 20 words. Please forgive me.